Thank you all for joining us for another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Very glad to have you with us as we come to the end of another week. This is, for us, week 9 of doing the show while sheltering in place. We continue to have our panelists join us by phone. I continue to do the show out of a spare bedroom in our house outside of the city of Decatur. And we're going to cover a lot of ground on today's show. We are going to start by talking about the Arbery case, and we're very pleased that we have with us Attorney General Chris Carr to talk with us to the extent that he's able to about the case, and he'll join us in just a moment. Jim Galloway and I will then go on. We'll talk about the latest in the coronavirus and politics in Georgia, and then we're going to talk about some election news as the June 9th primary approaches. So that kind of sets the agenda for the show today. First, Jim Galloway, glad to have you with us again today. Thank you for being here. You got some woodworking to do this weekend?
Yeah, you know, I've got to fire up. I've got a giant bandsaw I need to fire up on Saturday.
Boy, Jim, sure sounds exciting. I wish I had one. All right, let's get right to it, though. Chris Carr, Attorney General of the State of Georgia, thank you so much for taking time to join us today. And I want to make sure we try to ask everybody this. How are you holding up? How are things going in terms of sheltering in place? Are you finding anything difficult, unusual? Tell us a little about it personally.
First, thank you so much for having me on. It's always great to be with you and Jim. And if you said you are coming today from a spare bedroom, I'm in the dining room of our house, so that's where I am today. And so we're faring well. My wife Joan has the office, home office that she's got. I have the dining room table, and then our ninth grader is taking virtual classes down the hall in her bedroom. She's not there right now, but that would be. So we've got a school, we've got an office. We're multitasking here at the Carr House.
A busy, busy household. All right. General Carr, let me just very briefly talk about the timeline one more time as we set up our conversation, because I think the timeline is incredibly crucial to this story. Ahmaud Arbery was shot to death on February 23rd. The case was certainly, people knew about it certainly in South Georgia, in the Brunswick area where it happened, but it really didn't get a great deal of attention statewide, or certainly not nationally, for weeks and weeks after that. It wasn't really, I think, until April before people began paying attention to what had happened down there. What is even more troubling is that in the first week of April, one of the district attorneys assigned to the case, the second district attorney who had the case, George Barnhill, actually saw the video which shows how the shooting unfolded, but we didn't learn about the video until basically about a week or so ago. So I think I've got the timeline about right, and I'd like you to, you told Jim Galloway and other reporters that you were stunned when you saw the video and that you only learned about it, the Attorney General of the State of Georgia, when you got a friend pointed it out to you on Facebook. And you did say it was stunning to you to see what you saw.
I did, and it's right. On Tuesday, May the 5th, I was tagged around lunchtime and by a friend. And that's when we started talking internally, and we started talking to the governor's office and with the our friends at the GBI and others. But I'm a father and a human being. So when I saw that video, it was just shocking and it was stunning. Now, I think it's important also, you know, Bill, to point out this is why we're investigating. There is an investigation that is going on, and the purpose of that investigation will be to get to the facts. And then the facts will lead us to ensuring that justice is done. But that's how we initially found out about the video.
I want to give Jim a chance, but just one follow-up question. Jim, let me just ask a follow-up and then turn it over to you. I'm sorry. I believe you have said also, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that We know the case started with the DA in Glynn County. She decided to recuse herself from the case because of her relationship with the McMichael, the father. She turned it over to George Barnhill from an outside area. And I believe you said you were not brought into the picture and aware that that transfer had taken place. Am I right about that?
No. So let me just clarify this. I think a couple things too, Bill. Within 48 hours of that video being made public to the state, let me say this. I have to commend the speed by which the governor and Vic Reynolds, our incredible GBI director, moved to make this happen. So the governor directed Vic to reach out to Tom Durden, who was the third district attorney involved in this, the one that we had appointed after Barnhill. Within 48 hours, an arrest had been made. But within 12 hours of reaching out to Durden, the GBI was on the ground. Within 36 hours of being on the ground, the GBI made that arrest. So that's number one. No, our office was notified by Jackie Johnson on February 27th that she had a conflict. Our office, conflicts happen all the time. I've been attorney general now 3.5 years. There's about 671 conflicts that we've appointed when it's either a district attorney or a solicitor general. So when she notified us on the 27th, we appointed George Barnhill. George Barnhill was the DA until April the 7th when he notified us that he had a conflict. We appointed Tom Durden on April the 13th.
I apologize. I thought thank you. For some reason, I thought you weren't in the loop that early on, but I'm glad you've clarified that. Jim?
Yeah. Mr. Carr, as this case kind of exploded, I know Tom Durden, the DA down down in the Atlantic District, I think it is.
That's right.
Sent the case back to you. And could you walk us through, maybe in bullet point? Durden said that his office simply lacked capacity at this point. Could you walk us through the several investigations that are now underway, just bullet point fashion?
Well, sure. So that's right. When Tom got the case on April 13th, the case was at one phase, and since from April the 13th until we appointed DA Joyette Holmes from the Cobb District this past Monday, the case just grew in scope and size. And Tom reached back out to us and just said, our office doesn't have the resources to be able to handle a case of this magnitude and that sort of thing. And the Cobb DA's office does. They've got great resources and personnel and experience. And Joyette has been a prosecutor and a defense attorney and a judge and a great reputation. So that's why we went in that particular direction. So the GBI is investigating. Again, important to remember, there's an investigation going on to get the facts. So they've been brought in to investigate the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. So they've been brought in to investigate that. And we have now asked also the GBI to look into the communications and the actions surrounding the initial DA from the Brunswick Circuit, as well as the district attorney from the Waycross Circuit, George Barnhill. In addition, we've asked the U.S. Attorney's Office to come in to investigate that as well, remembering there may be federal law implicated at the U.S. Attorney's level. It could be civil rights issues. It could be public corruption type issues. And from the state's perspective, there are state laws that could be implicated. So they will be hopefully, again, we've asked the U.S. attorney to participate. They said that they were considering it. We have given them our file. We've made our personnel and employees available to answer any questions that they may have. And then the GBI is involved in their investigation.
Okay. Lee Merritt, he's a lawyer representing the Arbery family. A couple days ago, he was on a Sirius XM radio program, and he said that there is the presumption that this will come to trial in Cobb County. Is that correct, or does just jurisdictionally, if the Cobb DA is looking at this, does this go back down to Brunswick or automatically, or does it start in Cobb?
Jim, that's going to be a question that it would be better asked of the DA of Joyette Homes and how that process will play out. It's in Glynn County now, but that would be – we don't have anything to do now with the case itself. Joyette and the Cobb DA's office will be taking it, so that would be better asked of them.
I guess would it depend on where the grand jury is impaneled on it?
I think there's a number of different questions, and so I don't want to get into the specifics of that because those are going to be questions and decisions that need to be made by both sides kind of going forward, and so I don't want to speculate on what might happen.
Okay, sure.
So let me ask you a different take on that same question, Mr. Carr. I think to the dismay of many people in Georgia, even though you acted quickly when you began to unravel what had been happening down there in the Brunswick area surrounding this case, as you pointed out earlier, the governor spoke out, and he too was shocked when he saw the video. So I think that many leaders on both sides of the aisle have expressed here in Georgia their concerns about this case. But this case now, as you well know, has not just become a national story, it's become an international story. The lawyers now for the McMichaels have said, you know, they're dismayed at the quick rush to judgment that they believe that many people have made about what happened. Are you at all concerned about whether this case can whether a there can be a fair hearing of this case given the widespread publicity and the outrage that's been expressed? Can the McMichaels get a fair trial in a jurisdiction in South Georgia or in Cobb County, wherever?
Well, I know that those will be questions also that will be asked and brought up by both sides. I'll say this, though, Bill. You know, the important thing was that we get to the bottom of it, that we determine the facts. There is a right to a fair trial for the defendants, and there's a right to a fair trial for the victim and their families. And at the core of it all is uncovering the facts. And that was why I thought it was important. And again, there are a lot of very good people at the state level. As you mentioned, when the governor said when he saw it, he immediately asked the GBI director. And Vic Reynolds, being a former police officer and district attorney himself, he immediately acted and made sure that they were on the ground. Because the point being is, let's come at it from all angles. Let's make sure we work with anybody, the family, the community, our federal partners and our state partners to get the facts.
Hey, Bill, one thing we need to point out here is that that Joyette Homes, of course, is the Cobb County DA, but Vic Reynolds, the director of the GBI, preceded her as DA, which means there's a very, very kind of tight relationship, I'm assuming, between the two staffs, between the GBI and the DA's attorney. So that's an interesting combination. Mr. Carr here, when we talked about this on Tuesday, and what I find very different about the Arbery case is that Republicans as a group, yourself and the governor included, were very, very quick to identify this as an intolerable incident, and I think that's resonated at a national level. It kind of set the messaging for that. You told me that you were very determined to make sure that people understood that civil rights is not a one-party issue, that it's just as important to Republicans as it is to Democrats. Could you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Absolutely. Thanks, Jim. Yes, I believe that each and every human being has dignity and value and worth. And that is the fundamental civil right there, is the value of human beings, the value of human life, and making sure that everybody has a fair shake. And that's why I thought that it was important. And again, that no matter who I talk to, a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, you know, people of goodwill believe that exact same thing. And so what I was saying is, it is not within the purview of any one party. Republicans that I have talked to have been very much engaged in this, paying attention. They saw the video with their own eyes. Democrats the same way, independents the same way. So civil rights should matter. The value of human life, the dignity and the value and the worth that it's had. And I have said this to members of the community, and I got a chance to speak with Ahmed's mother the other day, and I told her the same thing. That's why it's important to get the facts, understand what happened, because a life was taken, and that life had dignity and value and worth.
Tell us about Amos Ackerman and his grandson, and how this fits into the Arbery case. It's just a little interesting kind of historical motivation.
It is. And Jim, I know about Amos Ackerman because of you and the Georgia Historical Society. When we went up a year and a half ago to Cartersville to dedicate a plaque to Amos Ackerman, who was, as I found out, didn't know who he was at the time, but he was Ulysses Grant's U.S. general. And he took on not only the railroad trust, but also
his attorney general, you mean?
Yes, I apologize. Attorney General of the United States. I should have clarified. The Attorney General of the United States for Ulysses Grant. And he got fired because he took on the railroad trust, but also because he had 1,500 indictments of Ku Klux Klan members. And so we went up there with Larry Thompson and others and had a chance to have a great day recognizing a Georgian that we just didn't know much about. He moved, you know, from the eastern part of the state to Cartersville. Well, as I mentioned, about in the beginning of February, I was picking up a book because I wanted to learn a little bit more about Thurgood Marshall. I knew he was a Supreme Court justice and had been part of Brown versus Board of Education, but wanted to learn a little bit more about it. And I picked up a book called Devil in the Grove. It's about the Groveland Four, a case out of Florida where four African-American men were accused of raping a white woman. And it became one of the more famous civil rights cases. Well, when Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP came in to defend at least three of the four. One of the men was lynched in a swamp in northern Florida. But for the other three, they needed to find a white member of the Florida bar, and the only one that they could find to take the case was Alex Ackerman Jr., the grandson of Amos Ackerman, who you and I had done the historical marker for. So it's really, I finished that book 2 weeks ago. And it just had been on my mind, and the tie between Amos Ackerman and Alex Ackerman in this in the case of the Groveland Four. So that had been on my mind as it turned out, this case was presented to us and the video came out.
Mr. Carr, both Joe Biden and Atlanta Mayor Keisha Waits Bottom have called this a lynching. What do you make of that kind of rhetoric when the mayor and a Democratic presidential candidate talks about this as a lynching? How do you respond to that? How do you react to that?
Our job is to go in and find the facts and ensure justice is done. And that the end game is that justice would be done. And because there's, you know, the investigation is going on, I don't want to prejudge or anything along those lines, but we do want to get the facts.
Well, I understand that, but is rhetoric like that harmful as you try to invest, not you to you personally, perhaps, but just in a more, in a broader way? Is that sort of rhetoric harmful in terms of the environment that's being created around this case? Or in fact, is it simply a judgment by people who have been as horrified by the video as you were?
Well, I can't speak for why other people do what they do, or I don't want to judge them. I come from the school of Johnny Isaacson, where you try to be constructive, and that's what we're trying to do on this. You know, from our perspective, we've got a job to do. I'm only focused on the job that the state has and in support of the GBI and others, and we'll let that, we'll just see where it takes us.
Let me ask you one more question. Chris Stewart, who is also part of the team that's representing the Arbery family, was on Political Rewind the other day, and he suggested that the coronavirus and the shutdown of court system shouldn't prevent a grand jury from meeting in a case like this. Immigration courts continue to meet. There are ways a grand jury could be impaneled. Do you have an opinion as to whether justice delayed is in some cases justice deferred in this case?
Well, again, there's a judicial health emergency that the Chief Justice has rightfully and understandably declared in the state. there was some guidance that came out on Monday that would at least, I think, address the issue of the grand jury. And so we have to play by the rules that are given. But we know that, as I've said, we need to swiftly, thoroughly, and transparently move this case forward. And I'm confident that Joyette and her team will do that as well from the state's perspective.
Mr. Carr, I'm not familiar with the judge's order there. Does it allow for the possibility of virtual grand juries from home?
From a virtual standpoint, and Jim, I don't have it in front of me, but it did provide some more guidance on when grand juries could be impaneled. And the point is to try to, you know, I know the gathering rule comes into effect, and how do you get people together to do that? And you're balancing public health with the interest of justice. So I would, he put out additional guidance on Monday, and I would just encourage folks to take a look at that.
Chris Carr, I know you have a 9:30 meeting. I'm sure it's on Zoom, so you're not going to be going very far, but we promised we'd get you out in time so that you could do that. We really appreciate your joining us today. And as the case proceeds, we may very well invite you to come back. But in the meantime, thanks so much for being with us today, Chris Carr.
Bill, thanks to you and Jim. Y'all have a good weekend. Take care.
We'll take a break right now and be back with more. Jim Galloway and I have a lot to talk about on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, we knew that Attorney General Carr was going to be very circumspect in what he did and didn't say about this case. He, after all, has to oversee how things develop on the case. But, you know, he made a comment to you, and I was trying to get at it a little bit. When he said that he had first heard, he told us on the air that it was May 5th when he first knew a video had been made of the shooting. A friend on Facebook tagged him on it. And the quote is, that's the first time I ever knew of the video. I was stunned. It made you sick to your stomach. The first reaction was, let's find out what happened. He had a visceral, emotional reaction, which we can all understand. I frankly can't even watch a video. I've heard it. I know about it. I just don't want to look at that. It just is too troubling. But there's no question that this case has cauterized the opinions of people like Carr, who jumped to action very quickly.
Right, and look, if you compare the reaction here to what happened in the days after the Trayvon Martin slaying, what happened in Missouri, what happened in Charlottesville. You know, it was the Republican, the conservative reaction was kind of top down. And quite frankly, led by impacted a great deal by President Trump, especially in Charlottesville, when he was saying, you know, there are very fine people on both sides of that issue. I think with the governor and with Carr jumping in so quickly, so forcefully, that the local GOP took control of the messaging on this thing, I think, in a very important way. And it was completely thorough. One of the things that I haven't written about and just want to make note is Marty Kemp, the governor's wife, was very prominent on Twitter in her condemnations. Mm-hmm. It's something you do not see a First Lady of Georgia doing.
Yeah. Well, and that does, to me, raise this question, which the attorneys for Travis McMichael's attorney, he and his dad each have hired separate attorneys in this. And by the way, we're still going to wait to learn, and it may be some time yet, whether they are going to argue they should be tried together or separately. That's still to be determined. But the attorneys for Travis McMichael held a news conference yesterday and raised this question, in which they said, everybody is rushed to judgment. It was what I asked Chris Carr about. And I think if I were an attorney for one of the McMichaels, I would be seriously looking at whether or not this case can be tried fairly. What jurisdiction in Georgia has not already had enormous outrage over what happened down there?
Right. Well, if it's at least any state charges would have to be tried somewhere within the state, I don't think there's any chance that it could be moved out of the state.
But where?
But, Yeah, and you know, these warnings aren't just coming from the McMichael attorneys. They're coming from the attorneys for Arbery's family. I mentioned early in the show Lee Merritt, one of the attorneys, on that same radio program on Sirius XM. He was advising African Americans in Georgia, in Metro Atlanta, and in Brunswick to watch what they say, to keep their mouths shut. About this, and especially on social media, because ultimately there's going to have to be a jury pool, and his point is, if you are interested in this case, you don't want to be disqualified from that jury pool.
And that's one of the reasons I ask. Go ahead.
Right, and voicing your opinion on social media would be a good way of being removed from the jury.
Well, it's one of the reasons I asked Carr about Mayor Bottoms calling this a lynching. It's a perfect example of what Merritt was saying African Americans should be careful about doing.
Right, and I wonder if in the weeks ahead, if you went back to Mayor Bottoms and asked her if she would repeat that phrasing, she might lower the temperature a little bit.
Okay. We'll watch how that all plays out in the weeks and months ahead. Let's move on. We got a lot of other political news that we can talk about. Are you game, Jim?
Oh, I'm game. I'm game. I got the drip already done, man. I'm way ahead this morning.
I know. All right. Well, you know what? Okay. So the Jolt is up there on AJC.com. I didn't, in introducing you, as I always do, frame you as the lead political writer of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Not only do you oversee The Jolt, which appears at AJC.com, but your column appears on Wednesdays and Sundays in the paper, and we're going to talk about the Sunday column, which is already online in a little while. Now, what's the lead item in The Jolt today? What should people be looking for?
Okay, this is kind of very, very interesting. Not many of you have probably heard of The Lancet. You know, if you're into sci-med news, you are aware of it. It's a 197-year-old medical journal. I think it's British-based, started in 1823. Mm-hmm. And they've got an editorial this morning, and basically saying Atlanta, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is based in Atlanta, of course, as everyone knows, needs rescuing from the Trump administration. It called the U.S. It was very, very critical of the administration for sidelining the CDC, even as it admits that the CDC really screwed up the testing in February on the front end. But it's calling U.S. response to the coronavirus. I think the phrase is inconsistent and incoherent. And actually, it pretty much calls for the replacement of Robert Redfield, the CDC director, who was testifying just before Congress this week.
Yeah, Redfield, though, it's interesting. This has kind of gotten lost because the CDC has had such a low-profile role, been eclipsed by what the president is, the way the president's taken the spotlight on this. Redfield was a controversial choice in the first place long ago, and there have been some stories that have been reported of CDC workers who have, without being named, have said they don't really quite trust Redfield's leadership in this. And here, by the way, is a quote from The Lancet, which you published in The Jolt. There's no doubt that the CDC has made mistakes, especially on testing in the early stages of the pandemic. The agency was so convinced that it had contained the virus that it retained control of all diagnostic testing for severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2. But this was followed by the admission that the CDC had developed faulty test kits, and it goes on. But punishing the agency by marginalizing and hobbling it is not the solution. The administration is obsessed with magic bullets, vaccines, new medicines, or a hope that the virus will simply disappear. But only a steadfast reliance on basic public health principles like test, trace, and isolate will see the emergency brought to an end, and this requires an effective national public health agency. That's a very powerful statement about the fact that CDC is the only agency that's out there to do that, just to oversee just those responsibilities.
Right, and one thing that the Lancet article points to is, if you'll remember, Nancy Messonnier, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. She's the director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. It's a kind of an arm of the CDC. She came out in late February, warning that this pandemic was about to hit, and it was about to cause quite a bit of disruption in the United States. She was out front in front of the president on that. There are reports that Trump was very, very angry about that. And we have not heard from her since.
All right. So the jolt's out there for people to look at. Another item in the jolt that we wanted to talk about today is the latest on Kelly Loeffler and the stock trade she made early on in the understanding that this virus was, in fact, much more dangerous than perhaps people had previously considered it to be. It got a lot of attention that she dumped, after an intelligence briefing, millions of dollars of stocks, and then at the same time acquired stocks in companies that would stand to benefit from the pandemic. She's been under fire for that for some time now. But of course, Jim, the big story yesterday was that it's Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, who was under the biggest cloud of doubt, because after a private briefing, he dumped a number of stocks. And yesterday we learned that the FBI had seized his cell phone and other records to further investigate him. And there were some questions initially about whether they'd taken the same action against Kelly Loeffler, seized her records too. What did her office say about that?
Well, this is what was interesting. And first, I would point out, you know, that transaction records are one thing. When you grab a senator, a sitting U.S. senator's cell phone, who is chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, although he's stepped down from that temporarily, that's a big move. That's a yeah, very big move. And here's how the situation played out, I think, yesterday, is that buried deep in a Politico.com report on the Burr action, there was this one paragraph which said, no direct quotes, just indirect quotes, Kelly Loeffler refused to say whether or not she had been, the FBI had contacted her. You know, that's a binary question. Either you have been contacted by the FBI or you have not. There's no middle ground in that one. And so what go ahead. By Thursday evening, she'd called my insider college, Tia Mitchell. I mean, she'd let Tia know that they sent out a statement that said, yes, they have handed bokus of documents to the SEC, to the U.S. Justice Department, and are cooperating in any fashion that's required of them. They wanted to change that headline very, very badly.
Yeah. Nevertheless, they did not. They still hedged the question of whether, like Richard Burr's case, the FBI had demanded to see her cell phone. We don't really know the answer to that at this point.
Right.
But we should also say, by the way, as long as we're talking about it, because I know some of the people who listen to the show will come after me if I don't mention it, this is a bipartisan situation, in the sense that Dianne Feinstein has also been asked to turn over records as well. There are some questions, although she says all of her holdings in financial properties are in a blind trust. She too has been under scrutiny in terms of all this sort of thing, right?
Yeah. No, she was required to make the same move that Loeffler was. To at least put something out there to let people know that that she's cooperating with everybody who's looking into this.
You know, Jim, I suspect that you've done the same thing. I've talked to a number of what I call mainstream Georgia Republicans here who have said from the start that they like the choice of Loeffler, they were supporting Loeffler, and I've asked a couple of them just how much damage do they believe that this whole thing is doing to her chances of winning election in the fall. Now, they're not going to tell me that they think she's toast. I mean, but they have expressed similar feelings that that by the time we get around to November, they believe that the pandemic will have dominated the headlines and that the stock transactions will not be much on voters' minds. I don't know that I think that's correct, Jim. I mean, we don't know at all, but this is a big deal.
Right. Number one, I would say it's, you know, where is the, what's the situation with COVID-19 in the fall?
Yeah.
And most importantly, what's the situation with the economy? You'll remember that Loeffler's wealth, she's pretty much the richest person in Congress right now. It was considered an advantage because she could self finance two campaigns in this year and in 2022, when she comes up she would come up for a full 6 years. In a downturn. In a downturn, being a multimillionaire, or I guess a half billionaire, because she's worth maybe $500 million, is your advantage lessens there, because you know you've got people in different boats there. We've mentioned on the program that it's significant that you've got several congressional candidates in the ninth, Republicans in the ninth and the 14th and the 11th, who have. Sided with Doug Collins, who's the Republican congressman from Gainesville, who's also challenging Loeffler in defiance of the governor. But you did have, I think it's important. You had Bubba McDonald statewide. He's on the PSC. He came out for Collins, I believe, last week, maybe 2 weeks ago. Yesterday, you had Tim Echols siding with the governor and with Loeffler. So I find that very important because Tim Echols is very much a movement Republican. You know, he taps very deeply into the homeschooling movement that's very big with Republicans. And I think that's a really important indication that a good segment of the Republican Party is sticking with Loeffler and Kemp.
Absolutely. That was essentially what I was saying when I've talked to some of the mainstream Republicans. But it's also an indication that the selection of Loeffler has continues to cause a real rift among Georgia Republicans. The most conservative Republicans who have always been supporters of Doug Collins, who cheered him on in the Judiciary Committee impeachment hearings. They're sticking with him. They're angry about Loeffler. And then those others like Tim Echols and the mainstream Republicans I talked about are going to stick with Loeffler. It's not a good situation for the Republican Party in Georgia right now.
No, well, it's a very divisive situation. Of course, you'll have the Doug Collins campaign very forcefully saying that if Loeffler gets into one of the two supposed berths in a runoff after November 3rd, that she could be taking her candidacy will be taking other Republicans down ballot with her. Yeah. It's a really, really interesting situation that we've got.
So I want to turn to Senate race number one for a moment, because there's an interesting development in that race that may suggest the damage that the coronavirus and handling the coronavirus is doing in races across the country. The Cook Report, which is certainly one of the most authoritative prognosticators of elections in the United States, has moved the David Perdue seat in the Senate from likely Republican to leans Republican. It's interesting. We have not heard Perdue. I mean, Perdue, who is one of the biggest supporters and has been for 3 years now of President Trump, we haven't heard. We've heard Perdue issue news releases, give some interviews about many aspects of what's happening in America today in terms of the coronavirus, whatever, but not forcefully supporting the president and talking about the good work the president has done. But you know, it may be a sign moving from likely to leans that Cook's people do see the coronavirus having an impact here. We know it's having an impact in races in other states with Republican incumbents. What do you think of that?
Well, I think what you're seeing is you've got we've got the link to the Cook report in the Jolt. I think what everybody's pointing to is the fact that the coronavirus and Donald Trump are being linked very, very closely together. And you're going to see we've got a mention in the Jolt of Bluestein came up with it, Greg Bluestein, with a new internal GOP poll that shows basically Trump and Joe Biden within the margin of error of each other in an internal survey. And if you count again, as you mentioned, Perdue is very, very has kept himself very, very close to Trump, and so it's not surprising that his support could take at least a slight hit as Trump declines. And I think it's going to be very important to see what Trump does in Georgia in November. We could have a big surprise.
We got to get to a break, but before we do, going back to race number two, our good friend Todd Rehm, a panelist on the show with some consistency, just sent us a note saying that one of the main reasons that this race between Loeffler and Doug Collins is going to stay hot all the way to November is that Collins is going to trash her relentlessly, is the language that Todd used in the note that he sent to us.
Oh yeah,
he's right about that.
she's kind of in a pincher situation, and that's it. I hate to say it, but it's starting to look like Jimmy Carter's appointment of David Gambrell back in 1973.
Jim, I wish we had time for you to go in and explain exactly what that means. Why don't everybody can just search David Gambrell, 1973.
Well, and the rise of Sam Nunn.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's do this. We got to get a break out of the way. We have a lot more to talk about after these messages. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway is with me. You know, Jim, it's fun. We don't usually get a chance to just chat one-on-one about politics, but since you're the dean and know it all, I'm really happy to be able to give you the chance to talk with me, just you and me.
Oh, we can generate all kinds of historic footnotes, you and me.
By the way, during the break, you talked about David Gambrell and Sam Nunn in 1973. During the break, Tom Faust said in my ear, I'm not even going to tell you how old I was in 1973, which is when I made a rude gesture to him just to see each other.
I almost made that same gesture when Attorney General Chris Carr told us that he had graduated from Marist in 1990.
Yeah. There is a market research firm, Jim, that I think you've quoted in the Jolt, and I communicated with them. They've started sending us polling data. They're doing some surveys of attitudes in Georgia about a variety of political issues, and they're a reputable marketing research firm. They've expanded a little bit. They like the idea of getting some attention for talking about issues that matter to Georgians. And I think it's worth just a couple of minutes. They asked the question of overall, do you approve or disapprove of Governor Brian Kemp's handling of the corona? By the way, it's Cooper Strategies, I think is the name of the firm. Do you approve or disapprove of Governor Brian Kemp's handling of the coronavirus situation in Georgia? If you take strongly disapprove and somewhat disapprove, you come up with 62% of Georgians. If you want to take somewhat approve and strongly approve, you're at only 36%. So, I mean, and the governor's acknowledged lately, he was sort of sanguine the other day, I thought, Jim, when he acknowledged that he understands that people are going to take issue with him, and he feels that he's in a very difficult situation and that he has tough choices to make and things to balance. I thought it was interesting that he knows public sentiment still seems to be against him. Another question in this poll was, do you believe Georgia is opening too fast, too slow, or just right? 67% said it was opening too fast. And but again, the governor seems to now have settled in a place where he says, I know there are people who strongly disagree, but I've got a balancing act to do here. And I suppose right. He does. But the fruits of this will be seen in a couple of weeks if the virus really spirals back out of control.
No, exactly. And the poll that you're citing there is tracks very closely with a Washington Post Ipsos poll that was out on Monday, which kind of looked at how governors are being rated as they handle things. And in Ohio, Governor DeWine, a Republican, got the highest marks, I think, in the 80s. And Kemp was down at 38%.
83% approval. Yeah,
and he was, and Kemp was down at 38%. Look, you know, I think one of the things that Kemp is picking up on is the need to communicate a whole lot more as he makes his decisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he took a lot of heat when he announced Georgia was going to open back in late April. Especially from Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms and Michael Thurman, who and Hardy Davis in Augusta and the mayor of Albany, all of whom said that they had not had any conversations with the governor. And I think his decision making circle is going to, over the next few months, is really, really going to have to expand as we get into some very fine details of how to deal with COVID-19. The Sunday column that you referenced is on this intersection that we've got coming of a pandemic and hurricane season. That could be very, very difficult come August and September.
Well, explain that a little more. And of course, we always know when we're talking weather in your column or on this show, it's because your daughter who works for FEMA is always concerned about the weather. But she points out to you that if we have another major hurricane along the southeastern coast and start seeing evacuations as we have in recent hurricanes, where are people coming? Are they're coming toward Atlanta? We don't know whether they're carrying the virus with them. We don't know if they're going to try to stay with people who may have the virus. It's a big concern coming up into entering into hurricane season.
Yeah, look, last August you had 110,000 flee Chatham County. Some of them went north into South Carolina. A lot of them came west toward Atlanta and many parts in between. You know, they came in buses. They stayed in shelters that were just packed, one person on top of each other. And I was talking to a couple days ago, I was talking to Dennis Jones, who's the emergency management director over at Chatham County. And he just kind of walked me through all the places that a pandemic can cause you to change what you're doing during an evacuation. The biggest one is it's not just sending people who might be infected with COVID-19 out of a coastal zone into inland areas. You've got to make sure that wherever you send those people, they're not being infected by the inland people. You know, it's a double-sided sword here, and that requires testing. The same emphasis on testing that we need to open schools, to open businesses, that's what we're going to need to deal with hurricane season. It's going to have to be immediate, it's going to have to be fast, and it's going to have to be in great numbers.
Thank you, Jim, for one more thing to worry about. We're fast running out of time for the show today, but I'd hate to leave. That's great. But I'd hate to leave it without at least a little bit of a nod to this interesting interview last night that Lawrence O'Donnell, a host at MSNBC, did with not just Joe Biden, but Stacey Abrams as well. Now, we really aren't quite sure what inspired O'Donnell to pair Biden with Abrams, whether he's promoting her candidacy for the ticket. I mean, he did, to the best of my knowledge, maybe he'll have Amy Klobuchar and Biden on Kamala Harris and Biden. But it was fascinating to see that pairing. And I suppose whether it was intentional or not, people who stay up late enough to watch Larry O'Donnell did get a chance to see how the two of them interacted with one another.
Yeah, and I wonder if you're going to see more of this. If this is Joe Biden's way of getting into people's living rooms through TV sets. I wonder if you're going to be seeing him paired with Kamala Harris, with Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah.
I did not stay up late enough to watch the video. The accounts that I'm reading of the Abrams Biden thing was that it was pleasant and polite, and everybody said nice things about each other. But it does give you the chance to see how those two people work and interact together.
Yeah, and certainly we know that Stacey Abrams took advantage of the chance to do another national TV show. She's certainly done plenty of them to once again talk about voting rights, to talk about voting integrity. The issues that she focuses on like a laser, you know, which also raises one question. And we got about 30 seconds to give you a chance to just say something about it. I've asked on this show a couple times, and I don't think I've asked you. Nobody has ever quite gone after the vice presidential nomination the way Stacey Abrams has. She's been very transparent. But considering that she ran her own race for governor against the wise advice of many Democrats who said she was taking the wrong tack, here's your 20 seconds, Jim. You can't fault her for being so aggressive in wanting to be on the ticket.
No, absolutely not. And just remember, this is kind of serves a dual purpose. It keeps her name out there. It keeps her fundraising active. And if she's going to run for governor again in 2022, that's she'll need all that.
Jim Galloway, that's all the time we have for today's show. Have fun with your woodworking this weekend. Thank all of you out there for being with us for another week of Political Rewind. My thanks, as always, to Jesse Neiswanger, Tom Faust, and Sam Burmis Dawes for the work they're doing. I hope you all have a pleasant and a safe and healthy weekend. We'll see you again next week for more Political Rewind.